Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Bratfold, Judge Larson, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for this October 6, 2022 panel. Our case before this particular constitution of the panel is McNabb v. And I know I've pronounced this before, and I'll get it wrong again today, and I'm sure counsel will correct it, but Kishelin, I believe, is the pronunciation.
Kishelin, and it took me 2 years, Your Honor, so you're in good company.
I missed two entire syllables, but thank you for that correction. Counsel, ordinarily, we would allow for 15 minutes for each side and 5 minutes of rebuttal to appellant, but in this case, we will only be hearing from appellant's counsel because only the appellant's counsel filed a brief in this case, and the respondent is represented pro se. Counsel, you will have 15 minutes to present your argument. Do state your name as you commence your argument for the sake of our audio recording of things, and be mindful of the timing restriction, which we will remind you of if you lose sight of. Also, if there's any glitchiness, since we're handling this by online presentation rather than in live court proceeding, if there's any glitching that occurs, video or audio, please bring it to our attention and we'll pause the proceedings and let the technology catch up to us. With that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Carl Blondin, appearing on behalf of the appellant. First, I have to apologize. In my brief, I have some question marks for item numbers in the record from district court, and those refer to my client's affidavit dated January 1st, filed January 6th, and it reads, John Kishelin's affidavit on income tax exemptions. And I believe the number would be 814, 815, 816, or 817. Unfortunately, those documents do not show up on the public computer view. This case involves a complex tax question. I have to confess, I got some coaching on it. I ask you to read my brief carefully. What I feel more comfortable arguing about are some of the procedural problems here, namely that the district court did not make sufficient findings. This is a case where the respondent is a CPA, certainly understands the tax law, yet she was not able to identify a single benefit, financial benefit she would receive by having the motion denied. My client, on the other hand, stands to gain thousands of dollars in benefits. And this, I know the court's going to ask, why is this different than 2019? Well, the circumstances of the parties have changed.
Let me pause you there. I have a different concern with your challenge to the district court's fact findings. So your client did provide an affidavit with representations about the tax consequences, exemptions, insurance, not supported by any expert testimony, not even citing the district court to what regulations, what statutes, what law would apply. And so as it regards your challenge to the district court's failure to provide adequate findings, if the district court didn't find your client credible and your client didn't provide the raw material for the district court to go off on its own and corroborate your client's claims, given the burden on your client, why would we say that the lack of findings, how could we say that the lack of findings, assuming that it was improper, caused your client any harm? How do we know whether your client was right, whether about the claims that are being made, or whether it would have had any effect at all without that basis for the district court's findings?
My client did include sample tax statements, records in his submissions showing.
Right, right. Your client included his own representations. And remember, your client's credibility was questioned by the district court. So if the district court is not required to believe your client, and your client is just saying, well, this is what, these aren't our actual tax records, but this is a sample of what would be provided. I'm not sure that we could either find clear error if the district court found findings inconsistent with your client's statements, or that we could say the district court, that the lack of findings caused your client any harm in light of that. Help me, disabuse me of that premise.
First, my client's submissions were unchallenged by the respondent here, who is a CPA. The law is clear. The law is written in Minnesota statutes 518.38 on income tax dependency exemptions for people like my client who are self-employed, who can benefit from the tax credit. The respondent receives insurance benefits through her employment, corporate benefits. My client has to pay for them himself. The benefit would accrue, so he gets a tremendous benefit, and he has to buy, if he is allowed the exemption. We can't do a complete 2022 tax return until the end of the year. So my client is saying, if the past is a guide to the future, here's what we're looking at. Here's what happens in 2022. Otherwise, my client...
There's an example there. So your client estimates the respondent's income by using quarterly amounts, seeming to emphasizing the first couple of quarters. Given her occupation, it seems to be without much dispute that those would be the quarters where she would spend the most amount of time and receive the most amount of income. He skips the third quarter, which is, I think, commonly known that, you know, when it comes to accountants, that that's not a quarter where they spend a lot of time. They certainly, that's sort of the reprieve period. But your client chose to present the court with representations about income that were based upon those quarters and not, I'm having a hard time seeing how we could identify any specific amount of benefit given your clients. Again, we don't find facts here. We don't weigh credibility, but the district court did and found your client not persuasive as a matter of on credibility grounds.
I'm not so sure it's the credibility. The court wasn't persuaded. I'm not sure why. My client did the best he could prospectively.
The district court said that your client offered no evidence of income beyond his own allegations. And implicit in that finding with the district court's conclusions, the district court didn't believe your client's allegations about income, either for himself or the respondent. And you can, again, correct me if you think I'm misinterpreting the district court's analysis.
Well, what I can say is my client's statement on respondent's income is consistent with what it has been in the past. There was no outrageous exaggeration.
Well, what about what I just mentioned about the choice to focus on quarters that that might tend to exaggerate her yearly income by focusing on those quarters where she, extrapolating from those quarters where she would receive the most income and not referencing the quarter where she would receive less income. Would that be a concern? Is that a reasonable concern for us? And would it not be a reasonable concern for the district court?
The way it should be a reasonable concern is that I would suggest that this court should reverse and remand and instruct the district court to hold a hearing, require the parties to submit the most current financial information they have so a proper analysis can be made.
Was that a request the district court received and refused? I don't see that as a basis for the appeal.
My client offered his tax information.
My question is, was there a specific request for the fact-finding inquiry that you say we should order on remand?
No, Your Honor.
And if not, what would be the procedural basis for us to find error in the district court's failure to engage in a procedure that wasn't requested by the parties?
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to point out that the child support magistrate found that the respondent's income was $114,000. I don't think it's unreasonable for my client to submit that to the district court judge.
I had a different, that wasn't my, I mean, with all due respect, that doesn't respond to my question.
Yes, procedural. You are correct, Your Honor. Well, then I would, Your Honor, then reverse the district court and award the my client his motion and the benefits he's asked for. These are many, many thousands of dollars at stake. The respondent will gain absolutely nothing from this order. It's quite simply a matter of spite. The child support magistrate in this case made a finding in the party's incomes for 2021. My client doesn't dispute that. He tries to project forward based upon what we had in 2021. I don't see how that there is. I think it's an abuse of discretion for the trial court to simply ignore the findings of the magistrate. It's the same court. It's a different judge. My client relied upon that in presenting his case. My client is not making up figures out of thin air. What he proposed was simply in line with what the history of the income of the parties has been, and is probably a very, very close estimate of what they will be this year. Now, hopefully everyone makes more money, but it's not unreasonable for him to look at 2021. I'd suggest it's unreasonable for the district court to ignore what the parties made in 2021.
Let me just point out one, you know, if you look at Exhibit A, one of the things, or no, I guess it's Exhibit C, your client provided to the district court what appears to be some calculations. It looks like a screenshot of Blue Cross and Blue Shield premium costs without any reference to where this information came from, and more significantly, without any testimony as to what was inputted in order to generate the monthly premium amounts. So I'm having a hard time seeing how the district court would be acted improperly by failing to enter findings that are based on this type of evidence that was, again, statements made by your client, or and this wasn't the only screen grab that wasn't supported. I think there's newspaper articles. Just sort of, these are things that might be interesting, but aren't necessarily facts on which the district court could enter findings without some further foundation. Which is why I have a hard time thinking that we could reverse the district court for failure to enter findings on this type of evidence.
Hey, first, I apologize. I bumped something on my computer and lost my video for a moment. Your Honor, I think my client sets that out in his testimony, in his affidavit. And, you know, I was not trial counsel. Maybe it's not the way I would do it, but I respectfully submit that it's sufficient to show, hey, this is what people are going to be paying. This is what costs are. We have a problem here where the district court has basically ignored all these statutory factors in 518A.38 subdivision 7. And if we look at those factors, as I stated, my client stands to gain many thousands of dollars. There's no showing that the respondent would gain $1. And she is quite educated in the tax law, but she makes no statement on it. I think, Judge Ross, I think it's page 16, paragraph 76, my client sets out the difference in premiums, prescriptions, visits, and co-pays. I think that would help answer your question, that part of the affidavit. Looking at what the costs are. And the respondent, once she's married, she will not qualify for head of household. My client does qualify as head of household. His income is significantly less. He stands to gain a tremendous amount, which in the end will help the child. The total family situation, the finances, the total money everyone will have will be increased. There's no harm to the respondent and my client getting this benefit.
You say once she's married.
I don't know if she's married or not yet, but she was engaged the time of the hearing. And one of the problems is the respondent is not always forthcoming. I'm told she's been married, but that's not part of the record. At the time of the hearing, she was engaged. I'm told everything is fine. She's now married, but I must confess that's not part of the record. So I'm not going to assert that.
And we wouldn't issue a decision. I mean, you wouldn't expect the district court to issue a decision based upon a marriage that might not occur.
Certainly not, Your Honor.
There being no prejudice, of course, to re-raising the issue. It seems like your client's certainly not averse to raising issues. One last question I'll have, even though your time has expired, and my colleagues also might have further questions, and I'll make sure that everyone has an opportunity to a conversation with you if there's more to be discussed. But what, if any, part of our court's prior decision do you believe applies with regard to the exemption issue would apply in this case?
You mean your court's?
Yes. Yes. Do you believe there is any rationale that has continuing application here?
I'm not sure I can answer that. My answer would focus on 3 years difference in time. It's changed circumstances. Instead of two children, we have one. This was 2019. Previously, it was 2019. Now it's 2022. I can't think of anything that would really apply. We have very different factual circumstances.
Thank you. Any questions further by my other panel members before we leave Mr. Blonin?
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Blonin.